From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. We've been parsing out the details of that massive $1.9 trillion coronavirus bill up before the House. And today, we're taking a look at a piece of it that proponents are calling the most significant piece of legislation for black farmers since the Civil Rights Act of 1964. As part of the American Rescue Plan, the bill would earmark nearly $5 billion in debt relief and support to acquire land, which black farmers have drastically lost over the last century due to systemic discrimination that has led to a cycle of debt. Joining us now for more on the significance of this legislation is John Boyd Jr. He's been working for more than 30 years to get this kind of relief. And Boyd is a fourth-generation farmer in Virginia and president of the National Black Farmers Association. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, and glad to be here.
As I mentioned, black farm ownership has sharply fallen in the last century. In 1920, 14% of farmland here in the U.S. was black-owned. According to the census, by 2017, that number dropped to only 2%. What are some of the day-to-day obstacles black farmers and other farmers of color face when trying to get loans to maintain their land?
Access to credit. And, you know, the loans that we were lucky enough to get from the United States Department of Agriculture took too long to get, with the processing time for a white farmer is less than 30 days, and a black farmer was 387 days. So wide disparate figures, where I personally had my application torn up and thrown in the trash can. I've been spat on. I've been called the N-word. And many of the people, especially longtime serving senators like Lindsey Graham, was in office when I was facing all of this discrimination. And he never used his megaphone from the Senate to denounce what black farmers were facing. And so many from the Republican Party are taking pot shots at a group of people who really don't have the resources to defend themselves. I find it deplorable.
Does this feel like reparations?
I don't like to use the word reparation because I'm not finished getting restitution from the United States Congress. This is something where we just need to right the wrong in American history. We've been slaves. We've been sharecroppers. We survived the Jim Crow era, and we survived all the discrimination from the Department of Agriculture that everyone knew existed. And we're going to have to get reintroduced to USDA because we're going to have to sign up to get that relief, I'm thinking. So we still have lots of work to do.
To your point, I mean, we've seen relief efforts before. There's the USDA's $2 billion payout back in the 80s in response to two class action lawsuits brought on by black farmers who alleged racial discrimination for the department's distribution of loans. Yes. Some say where we are today shows that that effort did not go far enough. I mean, do you have concerns that the relief in this bill will not go far enough?
It's hard to put a figure on how much discrimination and discrimination, people, is painful. It doesn't feel good when I'm not able to plant my crop on time or have so many less yields because I planted late. This discrimination is painful. It tears down families. And when a farmer loses his farm, he loses his sense of dignity and self-awareness in that community. And for years, we didn't have any type of oversight system in place where we're filing complaints to a civil rights office that was closed in 1983. And this is a clear right and wrong issue where a group of people has been done wrong by the very government that's supposed to be lending a hand up to farmers was the very same hand that was almost putting us out of business through a county committee system that pretty much today is still lily white. This is an uphill battle, and I'm aiming to fix it. It's going to take some time, but we need the support of the American people to get behind the black farmers movement and really take a look at what's going on and what happened to us in this country.
Support by the American people. And as you said, a forging of a new relationship with the USDA.
Yes.
What keeps you going through all of this? I mean, you have still made this a commitment to being a farmer.
The faces that I see and I dream about, such as Linwood Brown, Sylvester Warren, John Moses Bonner, all pioneers in the early on black farmers movement. And when I bought my first farm at the age of 18, those farmers were senior statesmen to me. And I had a white farmer in my community when they sold my farm, the USDA foreclosed on one of my farms. He said, well, Boyd, why didn't you get debt relief or debt write-off like I did? He said, they wrote off $400,000 for me. They could have easily wrote off that $40,000 that you were behind on your loan. And people, that's been 25 years ago where white farmers were getting debt write-down and loan reamortization and rescheduled payments to help them stay on the farms. Black farmers should have got those same services that white farmers were getting, and there would be a lot more black farmers tilling the soil today.
John, thank you so much for speaking with us, and thank you for your work.
Thank you for having me.
John Boyd Jr. is a fourth-generation farmer in Virginia. He's also the president of the National Black Farmers Association, talking with us about a plan in the relief bill that would offer debt relief and additional support to black farmers.
Well, the threat of deportation no longer hangs over more than 300,000 Venezuelans. The Biden administration is extending temporary protected status, or TPS, to Venezuelans who fled the political and economic crisis in their home country. This will allow them to remain here with legal status for now. Many of these Venezuelans are in Florida, so let's bring in Tim Padgett, America's editor at our member station WLRN in Miami. Tim, welcome back to the show, and what's the reaction been to this in the Venezuelan community where you are?
Oh, quite a bit of relief. This is something that the Venezuelan exile community, especially here in South Florida, which has the largest Venezuelan community in the country, this is something they've been seeking for years. Because, as we know, the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela has only been getting worse in the past 5 or 6 years. We've seen almost a fifth of the population there flee the country. And so this has been a very important requisite for Venezuelans all over the country here.
And when you talk to people who are living in Florida from Venezuela, what do they tell you?
They're telling us that this is changing their lives in many ways. I spoke to a young woman yesterday named Daniela. She asked us not to use her last name because her immigration status is still in quite a bit of limbo. But she pointed out that the reason she came here from Venezuela was to escape the terrible violent crime there. Venezuela now has the worst violent crime in South America. So she came here to study. Her visa has expired. And this is changing things quite a bit for her now.
I feel very relieved because I wasn't scared that I have to go back. I'm here because I was almost kidnapped in Maracay. So I applied for the student visa to study here in the United States. And my visa is already expired, but now we have the TPS.
And she also pointed out that being able to stay here will allow her to send money, food, things of that nature back to her family in Maracay, Venezuela, which is also suffering quite a bit economically.
And some context here is that a country can be designated for TPS for several reasons. If there's an ongoing armed conflict, if there's an environmental disaster, or extraordinary and temporary conditions. What exactly did the Biden administration say its reason was for offering Venezuelans TPS?
I think it would have fallen in that latter category. You've got the worst humanitarian crisis going on in Venezuela in modern South American history. And it has a variety of causes, some of it political. The authoritarian socialist regime there has become extraordinarily repressive over the past decade. So you have a whole toxic cocktail of factors that I think pushed the Biden administration to realize that Venezuelan exiles who are here do have a certain refugee status to them.
People from other countries like El Salvador, Haiti, and Honduras have been pushing administrations to make the temporary status more permanent because in many cases they've been living in the U.S. for many years now and their lives are established here. So for the Venezuelans, you know, this is just starting. But generally speaking, how much has the TPS issue been a part of the political debate in Florida?
Oh, quite a bit. And I think one of the reasons that they tolerated the fact that President Trump did not extend TPS to them when he could have was because there was a large confidence within the Venezuelan community here that it might not be needed because his policies were going to bring down that socialist regime. That didn't happen. And now I think there's a different feeling in the Venezuelan community. They're wondering now, why didn't he extend TPS to them instead of the lesser gesture of what's called DED or deferred enforced departure, which also protected them from deportation, but which he didn't offer to them and give to them until his very last day in office back in January. So I think you're seeing a sea change in feeling right now in the Venezuelan community about this whole matter. And I think there is a lot of gratitude toward President Biden right now, which is a big change from, say, back in November before the election, when Trump had convinced many Venezuelan voters here that Biden was, quote, a socialist.
Hmm. And just briefly, what is the time frame we're looking at here? I mean, by definition, this is intended to be temporary.
The intent is to give people who have come here to escape situations like Venezuelans 18 months of temporary protected status. And if conditions don't improve in the countries that they have fled, those 18 months can be renewed.
Tim Padgett, America's editor at WLRN in Miami. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With the pandemic still raging around the world, it's worth noting that people are still dying of other preventable diseases like HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and Ebola. That's especially true in underdeveloped countries, what our next guest calls the Global South. Eugene Richardson is a physician and anthropologist who's worked in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Sierra Leone, South Africa, Peru, and elsewhere. He says the global public health system is broken because it perpetuates an imbalance of power rooted in centuries of colonialism. Eugene Richardson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And I guess the most fundamental question is, why do so many people around the globe still die of preventable diseases?
Yes, I think that is the number one question of our century. How is it that we have such technologic feats to prevent death and disease and extend people's lives so much more than in previous centuries? And we actually have the resources to extend that across the globe, but we don't actually do it. And you'll hear excuses from, well, there are backward cultures that don't accept modern innovations, or that it's a logistical problem because there's not enough road infrastructure or electricity. But I think when you look at the history, it can be boiled down to a primary logic of othering people and then extracting from those other people, whether it's in the form of slavery or colonialism or now neocolonialism, economic extraction and colonization of the mental universe of former colonies.
And can we drill down into that just a little bit more deeply by looking at your own experience? I understand you've spent a lot of time in Western Africa working on Ebola outbreaks. How did that experience shape what you're telling me?
From my very first experience on a Doctors Without Borders mission 17 years ago in the Sudan to, yes, working in the West Africa Ebola outbreak and then the one in DRC, you're witness to the suffering and much of it preventable. And then, you know, you start to see the ways in which aid and, you know, global health science, you know, academic work, you start to watch the ways these are employed. And at least for me, the realization slowly dawned that these are not methods that are ever going to solve the problem. In fact, they may be methods that perpetuate it. You could look at a report called Illicit Financial Flows, I believe, in conjunction with the Jubilee campaign. You know, in 2017, they showed that on the continent of Africa, that $160 billion went into the continent in the form of aid and loans and remittances, but $200 billion came out in illicit flows, illegal extraction, tax evasion, trade misinvoicing, resource theft. And so it really shows that extraction continues to this day under different guises.
Draw the connection for me. How does that apply to what you describe as the traveling circus of humanitarian relief and epidemic research? Are you talking about the same thing?
Yeah, I'm identifying both emergency humanitarian aid, you know, Doctors Without Borders showing up for earthquakes or for, you know, Ebola outbreaks. And they do great work. And they save a lot of lives. But to me, that can't be the solution. I sort of see, you know, the MSFs and the Partners in Health of the world as forms of transitional justice on the road to global equity, not as social justice in themselves.
You go as far as saying that public health has been purposely underfunded in some countries. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, using the example of Sierra Leone or the Democratic Republic of Congo, you know, we calculated in a paper first for Sierra Leone that where there's lots of diamonds, very rich, diamond-rich country, and most of it's been thefted out. And just the taxes alone on 90 years of diamonds would have provided enough money to build a health infrastructure that would have stopped Ebola in its tracks back in 2014. Mm-hmm. So you can really trace these histories of extraction to the modern outbreaks. So to say that people are responsible for the outbreaks because of their ignorance and calling them super spreaders, instead of calling the mining companies that steal the diamonds super spreaders, is to me just a perspective choice. And so the intervention is not MSF, it's actually reparations for these colonial legacies.
And when you say reparations, what does that look like?
It can take different forms around the world, but the idea comes from, you know, you can use Malcolm X's metaphor of when a knife is stabbed into someone's back, you pull it out just a little bit, and that might be a metaphor for the aid industry. The patient still suffers. You have to pull it all the way out and heal the wound. And so reparations can be thought of as healing the wound.
Is it money?
So in some places it is. The people working on reparations for descendants of people enslaved in the U.S. are mostly focusing on the wealth gap. But for our colleagues in South Africa, they're actually looking at more at land reform. So the returning of land that was stolen by settler colonists. So it can take a different form in different settings.
We've been talking about Ebola and the consequences of colonialism, the legacy of colonialism over the years and how that's led to deaths. What about in the context of something that the entire world is looking down right now, COVID?
Each outbreak provides a different lens onto forms of coloniality. The most striking one in the COVID pandemic is the one of vaccine apartheid.
This is the idea that rich countries are getting access to the vaccines and the poorer countries are still far behind.
Exactly. It can be looked at as tragic for a number of reasons. One, morally, it's disgusting. Two, it's, you know, economically leaving the majority world to continue to suffer from lockdowns and collapsed economies is bad for the entire globe. And then the variants that could be produced in under-vaccinated areas will come back to haunt the vaccinated areas. A vaccine equity plan could actually be a first step on the road to various global reparations programs.
So I think we're getting to the next logical question then, which is, if we start with this premise that people around the globe are still dying of preventable diseases, how do we solve that problem? How do we keep them from dying?
You know, I think we have the good examples of what I called transitional justice, the MSFs and the Partners in Health of the world, and they need to continue to do good work. But the focus has to be beyond them to achieve global health equity. There's got to be real economic change so that countries in the global south can, you know, use their riches to actually procure some of the life-saving, transforming medical findings of the past century, from vaccines to antibiotics to everything we do in the hospital. That's why I keep coming back to this notion of reparations. You know, only through repairing these legacies can there be more of an equal footing to then move forward to achieve global health equity.
Eugene Richardson, physician, anthropologist, and assistant professor of global health and medicine at Harvard Medical School, also the author of the new book, Epidemic Illusions. Dr. Richardson, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much.
It's been about 1 year since coronavirus restrictions started being imposed by public health officials who saw the real threat of the spread of COVID-19. And most of us, 1 year ago, thought we might be working from home for only a few weeks to bend the curve of infection. Of course, we soon learned that COVID-19 would change so much of our lives and cost so much for so many. We've been thinking about the year of COVID this week and reflecting, and today, Karen Miller-Medson, one of our producers at Here and Now, shares some of her thoughts.
A year into the pandemic, the memory that still feels a bit like a gut punch
was the moment that I realized that the virus wasn't only in the United States and it wasn't only in the community, but that it had reached the hospital where my husband was working as an emergency doctor. It's one of the busiest emergency rooms in a very busy city. And the patients were coming in infected with COVID, one after another after another. And we were watching news reports out of Italy where doctors were becoming infected and dying, and out of China where doctors were becoming infected and dying. And we realized that the risk for him was significant, that we needed to change our lifestyles entirely, not just quarantining at home, but quarantining from one another at home. All of a sudden, we were wearing masks 100% of the time. We slept in different rooms. We used different bathrooms. We didn't eat at the same table. And we realized that that was going to go on indefinitely. There really was no end in sight. I think back to those moments of not seeing our children, not going to grocery stores or walking with friends. And we certainly were not alone. Many, many people were making those sacrifices. I'm happy to say that my husband is now vaccinated and all those restrictions are now dwindling, and it's a breath of fresh air, and I wish that for everyone.
We want to know from you. What are you reflecting on this past year? What memories of coming together or working together in those early days are you thinking about? Tell us by sending an email to letters@hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
Neuroscientist Kimberly Noble wants to know, if a family gets more money,
does it directly impact children's cognitive development?
Ideas about the brain. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Jury selection in the trial of Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis has begun after a one-day delay. Chauvin is the former police officer charged with murder and the killing of George Floyd. The death made Minneapolis the epicenter for civil rights protests that rocked the world last year, and the trial has put the city on edge again. NPR's Adrian Florida joins us now from Minneapolis. And Adrian, jury selection was delayed yesterday, but the judge decided to move forward today. Catch us up. What's been happening over the past 24 hours in this case?
There's this pending question about whether Derek Chauvin will be facing an additional third-degree murder charge. This is something that prosecutors for the state have wanted to add because it widens their possibility to win a conviction against him. But that's a question that's tied up in an appeals court right now. Yesterday, that delayed the start of jury selection by a day, but the trial judge in the case decided to begin this morning anyway to proceed pending any kind of ruling from a higher court. And that's what's happened this morning. We've started jury selection.
Well, because this is such a high-profile case, it might be tough to find a jury. What sort of things are the lawyers looking for in potential jurors?
Well, you know, in this case, as in any case, right, the goal is to seat an impartial jury. Lawyers and the judge this morning have been asking potential jurors whether, given the high profile of this case and everything that, you know, they know about it, whether potential jurors could set aside any strong opinions they might have and consider just the evidence in the case. It's also become clear this morning that both sides are very sensitive to the role of race in this case. The attorney for Derek Chauvin has been asking jurors about their views on Black Lives Matter, on Blue Lives Matter, on the protests that have erupted in the last year over racial justice. And so we've seen just one juror seated this morning. They've got a seat 12 and four alternates, and so it's going to take some time, three weeks have been set aside for this task.
Oh, wow. Wow. People who have been following this story know that barbed wire and barricades have gone up around the courthouse and police departments around the city. You've been out on the streets reporting. What have you seen and what have you been hearing from people?
People are anxious, you know, worried, nervous, depending on where people stand. They are optimistic about the possibility of a conviction against the former officer, but also nervous that if he is not convicted, that unrest could break out as it did after George Floyd was killed last year. And that's why officials here in Minneapolis have gone to extraordinary lengths to secure portions of the city which could be vulnerable, including the downtown courthouse, which, as you said, has been barricaded with barricades and fencing and razor wire. It's a lot quieter on the streets outside the courthouse today than it was yesterday. Yesterday, which was the scheduled start of jury selection, a lot of people came out to protest, demonstrate. There were marches. Today, this morning, as court proceedings were getting underway, there were very few people out. And that may be because it was unclear whether jury selection was going to begin today until it did.
Adrian, you said that jury selection itself could last several weeks. So what's the timeline for the entire trial?
Opening arguments in the case, regardless of how long, you know, as long as jury selection is done by that time, are scheduled to begin at the end of May. At the end of March, and the trial could last up to 4 weeks, maybe longer.
All right. NPR national correspondent Adrian Florido. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter.
At its height, the Baltimore Sun employed hundreds of journalists, with two daily editions and foreign bureaus throughout the world. Today, the paper is a shell of its former self after decades of cuts and changes in ownership. Well, now a group of former and current staff are hoping to revive Maryland's largest daily paper by turning it into a nonprofit. And with the help of a local businessman who is in the process of buying the paper from Tribune Publishing. Liz Bowie is a longtime education reporter for the Baltimore Sun and is part of this initiative, which is called Save Our Sun. And she joins us now with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
You know, the story of the Baltimore Sun is one that is very familiar to Americans throughout the country. We've all seen our papers become thinner, publish less often, and in some cases go away altogether. What does this second shot, so to speak, for the Baltimore Sun mean for its employees and really the community it serves?
We hope that it's a kind of new beginning for us. We hope that it will allow more money to be put into the journalism that has been reduced significantly in the last several years. And for our community, we hope that we'll be a stronger voice, delve more deeply into what's going on across the state. We hope it's a new beginning.
A new beginning that really does, as you said, serve communities throughout the state. You know, you mentioned the lack of investment. There are also a lot of other reasons for the decline in the Sun and lots of other papers. And it has to do with the way we consume news. It's changed. We just don't need a newspaper anymore to tell us what's going on in the world. That is the outsider perspective. But what is the proposition for people in Maryland to give the Baltimore Sun in this new iteration a second thought?
I think that the legacy newspapers throughout the country are still best equipped to tell the stories of their communities. We have many more reporters than any other news outlets in our communities, and we're able to do investigative work that generally hasn't been done by other medium. Granted, people don't think they need their newspaper, but I don't think they realize that there have been a lot of studies done that show that in towns that have lost their newspaper, people pay more money in taxes and corruption increases.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm hearing from you really is that in addition to re-educating those who may have strayed away from the paper to let them know, hey, we are the ones that cover your communities, you're also educating a new generation of folks who may not be used to or have ever had a daily newspaper. At one time, you all were publishing two newspapers a day, giving them the latest on their communities in such an in-depth way.
Actually, we have increased our subscribers pretty substantially in the last few years, our digital subscribers. It's just that our advertising revenue has been significantly reduced. And so we can't employ as many reporters and editors and photographers as we once did.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up about the business model, because the majority of revenue for newspapers comes from advertisement. How will nonprofit status change, if at all, your relationship with the communities that you serve?
You know, we've all seen the enormous success in the Washington Post and the New York Times. They have found the business model that works, but they're a national publication. And I think the next challenge now is to find that business model for local newspapers, the smaller regional papers that aren't going to become national papers, but could really do an excellent job of covering their communities and their, you know, states.
And in this effort to learn more about what your communities need, you will be also talking with younger readers of the community who may not actually have a touch point with newspapers. In that context, listening to the next generation of readers could mean your newspaper looks completely different than what we know. Are you actually prepared to use this moment to explore new modes and ways of presenting the news?
I think our newsroom is anxious to explore those new ways of telling stories. I think we would love to do podcasts. I think we'd like to explore things like TikTok. I'm sure we'll have utter failures, and I'm sure we'll have good success at some things.
I mentioned that you're a longtime education reporter for the Baltimore Sun. You've been there for several decades. How does this moment feel for you as a journalist? I mean, as I mentioned, it's kind of like a second shot.
For the past year, since I've heard that Alden Global Capital was interested in taking over the Sun, I thought that this might be the time to leave the paper. I had always wanted to work for the paper as long as it was fun and as long as I felt I could do stories that had meaning for the community. And so I sort of threw myself into this project, this campaign to save our Sun. If it goes through, it really will be an amazing moment for the city and the state. And I also think it could provide a model for the nation.
Liz Bowie is an education reporter with the Baltimore Sun and a leader in the push to nonprofit ownership of the Baltimore Sun. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Before the pandemic hit, daily commuters flooded into cities across the U.S. for office jobs. And that flow was unmistakable in Washington, D.C., where the city's population almost doubled in size every weekday, with commuters from Maryland and Virginia. But the pandemic changed all that, and a year on, D.C. officials are facing a frightening question. What if those workers never come back? Martin Ostermuhl from member station WAMU reports.
In pre-pandemic times, Steven Weinstein was like hundreds of thousands of other Washington-area commuters. Every weekday, he'd leave his house in the Virginia suburbs and commute into D.C., where he worked as a business analyst for a flower delivery company. But that all stopped last March, when, like so many other people, he was told to work from home. By this year, his company had given up its downtown office space altogether.
I think the plan was to have everyone start coming back in around June or July, but lease a smaller office and then have people come into work, you know, twice a week, something like that.
It's the growing number of stories like these that are causing many a sleepless night for D.C. officials. For years, office workers have been a foundation of the city's economy. But since the pandemic upended how and where people do their work, those officials, like many in other cities, are starting to face a future that may have fewer commuters coming into the city every single day. Jeffrey DeWitt is D.C.'s chief financial officer.
The normal percent of people that had jobs in the district but worked at home was around 7% pre-pandemic. We're estimating, and this is an estimate that no one knows for sure, that that's going to jump up to 20%.
Many local employers say they aren't yet abandoning their traditional offices and would like to have workers come back at some point. But they also say they're likely to allow more partial telework. A survey of regional employers by the Greater Washington Partnership found that while only 8% of workers teleworked one or two times a week before the pandemic, more than half expect to do so after it passes. That could mean fewer people out and about every day buying cups of coffee and lunches to go. On average, office workers in D.C. spend around $127 a week on food, services, and entertainment.
They're critical for the economic infrastructure of downtown D.C. and the city as a whole.
Neil Albert is the president of the Downtown D.C. Business Improvement District.
The office workers drive the transportation ecosystem. They drive the retail and restaurant ecosystem.
But as those ecosystems start to suffer, so does the city's bottom line. Here's DeWitt again.
There'll be less day-to-day activities that that generate sales tax to the district. And those buildings that are in will be generating less net operating revenue.
But it's not all doom and gloom just yet. Albert says there's still value to a centrally located office close to the subway system, the federal seat of power, and lots of things to do. There's also people who see what's happening now as an opportunity to reimagine what downtown D.C. could be. Tracy Haddon Lowe is an expert in commercial real estate at the Brookings Institution. She says D.C. was already seeing increasing vacancy rates in older office buildings that were becoming functionally obsolete. She says those buildings could be repurposed for residential uses.
The future is for downtown to become a neighborhood. It will still be a neighborhood that is far more dominated by commercial land uses than most neighborhoods. But absolutely, yes, more people should be living downtown. It will be good for the city.
In the meantime, there's going to be a few rocky years ahead for D.C. Hospitality officials estimate that upwards of 20% of all restaurants won't survive the pandemic. Still, D.C. CFO Jeff DeWitt says he's optimistic that the city will recover.
But people always have come back historically to the city. After the 1918 pandemic, the Roaring Twenties started. I mean, so there's this sort of human history of cities always, you know, recover, and some, not immediately, but sometimes better.
But for the time being, Washington, D.C. will feel emptier than usual. For Here and Now, I'm Martin Ostermueller.
You don't need me to tell you that it has been a particularly long winter, but there are signs that it's coming to an end. Daylight savings begins this weekend. Spring officially starts in a week and a half. And Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst has some suggestions for brightening up your cuisine with a little hint of the coming season. Kathy, welcome.
Hi, Peter.
And we're talking about lemons.
We are, indeed. I mean, for those of us in the Northeast, it's been a long winter of root vegetables, and we have not seen spring vegetables arrive in the market quite yet. So this is the time of year when I am absolutely like a cheerleader for lemons, Meyer lemons, regular lemons, lemons in soup, salads, main courses, and desserts.
Well, I'm looking at the weather forecast for where you are in Maine. It's like in the 40s right now. So I hesitate to tell you that I actually have a lemon tree growing in my backyard. And when my office window is open, I can smell the blossoms coming through. It's like, it's amazing. But it is a Meyer lemon tree. And actually, I find that Meyers do taste a little bit different. So how do you approach it? Do you use those the same way as a regular lemon?
They are slightly different. They're a hybrid citrus. They're like a cross between a lemon and a mandarin orange, and the entire rind is very edible, and it's more of a sweet and sour taste than just a straight-on sour, and it can almost always be substituted unless a dish you're cooking needs that serious pow of just straight sour. But
well,
I have very serious Meyer lemon envy of your tree.
I was going to say, it does explain why my kids like to suck on them, and I don't want to tell them not to, but, you know, they love it. So, anyways, you do have three recipes for us. The first one is for fish. Tell us about that.
This is a fillet of sole piccata. Piccata is an Italian word meaning to be pounded flat, and traditionally, this Italian classic is made with chicken or veal, but I like to use fish. You could use any type of thin, fresh, flat fish fillet, like haddock or mahi-mahi, snapper, and it's so simple. You dredge it lightly in flour. You sauté it. It gets paper-thin slices of lemon or Meyer lemon, some capers, and a splash of white wine, and you have dinner in about 15, 20 minutes.
Sounds delicious. You also have a recipe for lemon pudding, which maybe you can have after the fish.
Definitely. This is the ultimate in comfort food. It is creamy. It's got that bright lemon flavor and very simple, cooking some milk, a lot of lemon juice and lemon zest. But then if you want to up it a bit, you can candy the lemon zest. And I'm sure you're thinking, wait, candy? I'm not going to make candy at home. But all it is taking strips of the zest, the yellow outer portion of the lemon, cooking it in boiling water, and then throwing it into a simple sugar syrup, and they last for weeks, and they are so delicious on almost any dessert.
And tell me what you mean by the zest. I think you're referring to like taking a thin slice of it off the front of the lemon, but sometimes when I zest it, I also kind of just like grade the skin off.
Good. I'm glad you asked me that. The yellow part the external yellow skin is the zest. But very quickly, you hit the white pith, it's called, P-I-T-H, which can be quite bitter. So when you're grating the zest, I like to use a microplane, or you can use the little knobs of a cheese grater. You don't want to keep going to hit that white bitter part.
I see. Now, the last recipe you have for us is for a lemon cake that you say gives lemon flavor three different ways. How so?
It does. You use the lemon juice. You use the lemon zest. It's made with Meyer lemon or regular lemon again, and it's a very simple pound cake. Once it comes out of the oven, you take a fork or a skewer and poke little holes in it. And while it's still warm, you put more lemon juice into this warm cake. Mm. So it absorbs lemon juice at the end. And then you glaze the whole thing with pistachio and lemon. And this cake, breakfast, lunch, or dinner. I mean, it's March. We deserve a little something here.
Just real brief. Do you have any other suggestions for ways that we can use a lemon in the kitchen?
Oh my goodness. We don't have time for all of them. You can pop it in the middle of a roast chicken. You can grate it onto pasta and make a lemon sauce, salads, and zest. Keep in mind that one lemon has 30 milligrams of vitamin C, calcium, and fiber. So it's really good for you. One lemon is 20 calories. You can't go wrong. It absolutely will brighten virtually anything that you cook, particularly this time of year.
All right. Well, Kathy, just hang on a few days. I'm going to send you in the mail a handful of the last of the Meyer lemons on my tree. We're just about done with them. As I said, the blossoms are coming in. I'll do it. I absolutely will.
Peter,
we're talking about lemon recipes. Oh, good. I knew I could bribe you. Kathy Guns, thanks. We're going to link to all of your recipes at hereandnow.org, okay?
Thank you.
All right. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.